The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org.
On June 23, 2008, a distinguished panel of experts featuring Scott Snyder, Charles K. Armstrong, David Straub, and Young-shik Daniel Bong convened at the Korea Society to assess the first months of Lee Myung-bak's presidency. The panel took a close look at what has been a tumultuous period in Korea's domestic politics.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Korea Society. I'm Evans Revere, the president of the Korea Society. It's a pleasure to welcome you all here today for what I think will be a fascinating program, and certainly a very timely one if you've been following the newspapers and the television images coming out of Seoul over the last several weeks or so. If you see David Straub and I cringe periodically during the course of this program, it's because The picture that's up there is a little reminiscent of an experience that he and I had when we were in the embassy in Seoul back in the summer of 2002, when this was a daily occurrence, but for somewhat different reasons. But it does speak volumes about the nature of politics and political developments in Korea, that once again the streets of Seoul are filled with demonstrators who are concerned about an issue that, to some extent, involves U.S.-Korea relations, but to a large extent seems to involve important political developments domestically in the Republic of Korea. And for those of you, and I think that means most of you in this audience today who've been following the papers, demonstrations have been large, occasionally violent, and have presented some rather disturbing images, especially for Americans who may not be familiar with what this is all about. And the fundamental question that we're trying to answer today in this program is, what is this all about? Is it just about the beef? And I suspect you can probably already guess that the answer is no. And we have a very distinguished panel here today that we've drawn from all over the country to be here and talk about this important and timely issue today. They are all good friends of myself and good friends of the Korea Society and familiar faces, I think, to many of you here in the audience. And we have, as the chair of our panel today, a very distinguished scholar and expert among all the experts that we have on the panel today. Scott Snyder is senior associate in the International Relations Program of the Asia Foundation and Pacific Forum CSIS in Washington. He is a longtime expert on Korea and Northeast Asia. He's a noted author of some of the best books that you will ever read relating to North Korea and China-North Korea relations. He is someone who I have worked with on and off over the years on many aspects of U.S.-Korea relationship. I can't think of a better person to have sitting in the chair as we talk about a set of issues that are extremely important, not only domestically within the Republic of Korea, but to the U.S.-Korea alliance relationship and partnership. And so without further ado, let me turn the dais and the program over to Scott, who will take it up from there and introduce our panelists and treat us to an afternoon of what I think will be fascinating discussion. Scott, over to you.
Okay, thank you, Evans. It is a pleasure to be back up here at the Korea Society. And I think that we have an excellent panel today to discuss Lee Myung-bak's first 100 or so days. Before I introduce the panelists, I just thought I might help frame our discussion a little bit. First, by observing that the South Korean electorate has faced some pretty significant mood swings over the course of the past year, just in periodic visits I've made over the past year. I remember last fall a feeling of exasperation and even hopelessness, And then in December and January, rising expectations and quite a bit of energy and hopefulness about change. And then during a visit in March, I found that there was rising disillusionment. And I think that following that, we've seen a crescendo of frustration. And I don't know how people in Korea feel, but I'm feeling a little bit manic depressive watching all of the mood swings that are going on in the electorate in Seoul. Of course, it seemed like things were getting off to initially a pretty good start with the enthusiasm that we saw. But then the National Assembly elections were portrayed in the Western media, I think, as a big success for Im Young-bak. But if we looked at the Korean media, it seemed that he was a little bit more on the defensive. And then, of course, he was a president who won almost half of the electoral vote back in December, and yet his approval rating is now lower than 20%. And so that's really a remarkable change. And so it gives one pause, I think, to take into account that 100 days marks only 5% of Im Young-bak's term. And that actually, if you count the two leap years that during which Im Young-bak is supposed to be president, this is going to be the longest South Korean presidential term since the democratic transition. So I don't know if we're going to be able to make it through, but let's we'll do our best. And so I think that we have an excellent group of panelists to address. What has happened, what we've seen, and help us to understand what has happened over the course of the first 100 days of the Im Young-bak administration. To my immediate left is Charles Armstrong, professor at Columbia University and director of the Weatherhead Institute at Columbia University. I'm sure that he really needs no introduction to any group in New York. He is widely recognized as a specialist on North and South Korea, and I've had the pleasure of seeing him many times, both here in the U.S. And also in Seoul at various meetings. To his left is Daniel Young-sik Bong, assistant professor at American University and formerly got his Ph.D. at University of Pennsylvania. Has been doing some very active research on anti-Americanism and many other topics related to South Korean domestic politics. And then to my far left is David Straub. He's a career foreign service officer. I relied on him quite a bit during 2002 to understand the last round of candlelight demonstrations that were occurring in Seoul, as I was also there and had an opportunity to see some of those demonstrations firsthand. He brings a lot of experience and insight to looking at Korea and also has comparative perspective given many years that he spent in Japan and working on both the Japan and the Korea desk at various levels. And of course, he's now a Pantech Fellow at Stanford University and is the driver behind a project called New Beginnings that looked at the initial transition and the inauguration of Im Young-bak. And now I guess we have perhaps another new beginning, given that we have a completely new Blue House staff as of just last week. And so we're going to try to make this as interactive as possible. And what I'd like to do is just ask the first question to each of our panelists. And I think the place to start is what exactly accounts for the amazing drop in Im Young-bak's popularity and the public protests that we've seen in South Korea? Is it really just about beef, as Evans asked? Is it disappointed with Im Young-bak's administration, anti-Americanism, bad economy? What do you think are the real sources of discontent in South Korea right now? Charles?
Thank you, Scott. I do want to make one correction to your introduction. I'm no longer head of the Weatherhead Institute, but director of the Center for Korean Research, which is a subsidiary of the Weatherhead Institute, but I appreciate your kind introduction. It's It's great to be here, to see many familiar faces and some new ones, and to talk about this very timely issue. Usually there's not so much drama in the first 100 days of a presidential administration. And I wanted to not so much address the beef issue directly, but to talk for a couple of minutes about the general context in which we find these remarkable protests. It's not that often that Seoul gets on to top of the front page of the New York Times, but I'm sure most, if not all of you, saw the photos of the candlelight vigils a week or two ago, which were quite an extraordinary image of this, in some ways, very surprising turn of events. It has not escaped, I think, many people's notice that this is the 21st anniversary this month of the protests of June 1987, what some people call the Great June Uprising. And at that time, there, up to 1 million South Koreans went to the streets to protest the government of Chun Doo-hwan, which was seen as autocratic, if not dictatorial, as well as corrupt, and very much curtailing of individual freedoms. Now, a similar number of people are taking to the streets to protest what? The import of U.S. beef? Are these issues really commensurate? Is the anti-democratic protests of 20 years ago really anything like what we see today, or vice versa? I think what is important to keep in mind is that over the last 20 years, there has developed a almost unique culture of politics in South Korea, in which street protest has become very much entrenched in the life of Seoul and other cities. And that if we look at the formal political process alone, we can't really understand what's going on in the Korean public mood and Korean politics writ large. This political culture is characterized by street protest, candlelight vigils, viral media, and extraordinarily rapid exchange of information and mobilization of demonstrations. Koreans are always in a hurry, as we all know, and now President Lee has made a historic record of going from the winner of a landslide victory to the depths of unpopularity in only 3 months. So there is, in another sense, a kind of a rapid turnover. All South Korean presidents since 1987 have gone from quite high, usually over 80% popularity marks down to quite low, but none have done it as quickly as Lee Myung-bak. And I think part of the reason is that Lee's landslide victory actually masked some real weaknesses in his popular support. Yes, it's true that he won almost 50%, over 48% of the votes that were cast, but this was also the lowest voter turnout of any presidential election since 1987. And in fact, his actual percentage of the total eligible electorate is about a third. So he does not have, in fact, as great a mandate as one might have thought. What is this all about? Well, there are many factors going into this protest. This has had an unusually high number of middle and high school participants. So part of it might be to avoid studying and even going to school, and I think that should not be discounted entirely. Perhaps a certain nostalgia for the 1980s has come back. This is an issue that has been no doubt exploited by members of the political opposition and others. But I think there are a number of key factors that are the most important to consider. First, I'll list four of them and then conclude here. First, there is genuine health concerns. I think that shouldn't be dismissed out of hand, rightly or wrongly, even though there doesn't seem to be much scientific basis for it. There are a lot of Koreans who are genuinely worried about the quality of American beef and the health issues involved in that. That isn't the most important issue, but it's there. Second, there is a general anxiety about the state of South Korea today, and in particular the state of the economy. Much of which has nothing to do with Lee's policies, but Lee had the misfortune of coming into office at a time when the U.S. economy hit a major downturn and the entire global economy is undergoing a very difficult transition. The third and fourth reasons have more to do specifically with Lee Myung-bak. One is that his agreement, or some would say capitulation of the beef deal, confirmed many people's suspicions that he was too favorable to the U.S., that he caved in to U.S. pressure too easily, and that the South Korean people are, I think, no longer as willing to go along with U.S. interests as they once were, and I think Lee fundamentally misunderstood that, and then misunderstood the popular view of the U.S. and South Korea's role with it. So the anxiety about Lee's too pro-U.S. obsequious attitude, I think, is part of this. And although these protests are not primarily anti-American, I think the other panelists will have more to say about that, but mostly about domestic issues. But above all, the protest against the beef imports are largely, I think, about Lee's style of governance, which is perceived as being very heavy-handed, top-down, non-consultative, even arrogant. And in that respect, the criticisms of Lee are not that different from the criticisms of his predecessor, Noh Moo-hyun. And so we see a certain continuity there, which is more about a protest against style than about substance. The issues are overwhelmingly, I think, domestic rather than international, but there are some things that the U.S. can and already has done to help to alleviate the issue. And I think I'll stop there.
Yongshik, what's your take?
Well, let me just explain my take on the whole situation based on my personal history. Just like any other college professors, I live for long summer vacation, and my own way of unwinding is to go to local bookstores and read a bunch of books totally unrelated to Korea or international affairs. But surprisingly, that I get some interesting ideas that I can tie to my own observation of what the Lee Myung-bak government has been going through from the former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan's book and some business leadership books by Stephen Covey, The Speed of Trust. I guess the content of these books are quite relevant to analyzing what has been happening in Korea. So I'd like to give my own thoughts from the leadership perspective. Scott McClellan's What Happened, Inside the Bushy White House and the Washington's Culture Deception, and Stephen Covey's book, The Speed of Trust, taught me two lessons. One is that there exists a striking resemblance between the Bush administration and Lee Myung-bak administration. So if you want to understand the reason why President Lee put himself in a difficult position between a rock and a hard position, then we can delineate some lessons by going back to the history of the Bush administration for the past 8 years. Many people are worried that election of John McCain as the next president would be equal to a third term of Bush administration, but I would say that Bush administration already inaugurated its third term in South Korea last February. In addition to the striking parallel between the Bush administration and Lee government, I also observed that the Lee Myung-bak government's crisis illustrates the end of or the bankruptcy of the old mode of politics and economic development, which was highly effective and popular during the Cold War era. So I believe that the Lee Myung-bak government is likely to be remembered as the last surge of the Cold War generation in Korean politics. What I would like to emphasize today is that so far we've been comfortably analyzing the nature of Korean politics with one single axis, either Gyeongsangdo, Jeollado, or conservative, liberal, pro-national security, or pro-unification, pro-growth, or pro-justice. But I argue that because of the impact of generational change in Korean society, that in order for us to, as a Korean observer, to adequately analyze the underlying dynamics of the Korean society and politics, we have to add one more ethics, which is a generational gap, the Korean War generation and the post-Korean War generation. So the young conservative, although they are similar to the other conservative in, among the old generation, they're closer to their own generations with a liberal arguments and understanding. They share the same reference points and the understanding of the common history, although they differ as a conservative and liberal on certain issues. But the difference between old generation, the Cold War or Korean War generation, were either conservative or liberal, and the post-Korean War generation is more significant. At least the young generations can debate, representing different ideological spectrums with the same language, same worldview. But the communication or debate between old generation and the new generation in Korean politics is like trying to forge a communication between Martians and Venusian. I just want to point out some similarities, common elements between Bush administration and Lee Myung-bak administration, so which I believe help elucidate the reason why Lee Myung-bak government has come to such a difficult position. The one similarity is the philosophical background that both presidents have very strong sense of mandate. President Bush time and again emphasized that, quote, "I'm a war president. The war on terror, I'm quoting here, will determine my legacy, and how Iraq fits into that will determine my legacy." Of course, the key word for Lee Myung-bak government is not war on terror, but economic development. "I will unfailingly revive the economy" was the one of the most frequent lines during his election campaign. They also share another common element for dismissing the politics as usual, the separation of power, checks and balance. I guess both the leaders discovered this checks and balance system in liberal democracy quite cumbersome for expeditious problem solving, either in fight against the global terrorism or a collective effort to resuscitate the failing national economy. Of course, President Bush frequently, as a former Texas governor, criticized the other who he called activist judges. Scott McClellan cited what President Bush said, quote, "Results really do matter. And it was clear that for Bush, results meant getting his agenda through the way he envisioned it, not a watered-down version tainted by Democrats' input." And President Lee Myung-bak, as the very successful Seoul mayor, shared the same firm belief in expedient solutions, overcoming what he criticized as a Yeouido-style politics. Neglecting the baseline of checks and balance in the liberal democratic system came out to haunt both administrations. The results are the same, that the imperial presidency in the United States for the past 8 years, and which seems to be out of touch with the public. Headstrong style of leadership also exacerbate the sense of alienation among the Korean public for Lee Myung-bak government. So people, as Professor Armstrong already pointed out, began to increasingly question, entering into era of prosperity and putting our country in the ranks of the advanced economy is all good, but people began to ask, what's good in it for us? And this,
I'm going to come back to you and ask you some specific questions about what you've already put forward, because there's some very good grist for our conversation.
Sure. But, conclusion, that I'll just conclude it. So this increasing exercise of headstrong style of leadership exacerbate the sense of alienation among the public. And in the absence of functioning party politics, people had to come out in the street to let their voice heard.
You've raised some very interesting questions that we're going to come right back to, but first I want to hear David's take on the demonstrations and their causes.
Thank you, Scott. There are a whole complex of issues that I think explain how we got to where we are or where we were as of a few days ago in terms of the demonstrations in Seoul. But I think I will talk very briefly just about three of those. The first is, I would say, a negative mandate. I went to Seoul last December to watch the election campaign briefly and the election and talk with friends and other people there. And it was very clear that people were voting for Lee Myung-bak, not primarily because he was Lee Myung-bak, but because Noh Moo-hyun, his predecessor, had become very unpopular. And to a lesser extent, his party, the progressive, main progressive party, had also become very unpopular. They had been in office for 10 years, and so there was a great deal of fatigue, which I think is probably natural in any democracy when one power, one group, or one party or one group is in office that long. I suspect that having won such a great victory, that President Lee and his associates overestimated the extent of their own mandate. The second factor, I would say, is similar to what my colleagues have talked about, which is sometimes referred to as anything but no. Not only did President Lee, I think, come in thinking he had a bigger mandate than he did, but he and I think many of his colleagues thought that because of that and because of their own dissatisfaction with the policies of the progressives, that they were going to, that much, if not everything, that their predecessors had done was wrong and needed to be corrected. So we saw a lot of examples of that phenomenon. For example, even before the president was inaugurated, members of his transition committee were meeting with other ministry people and preparing plans for their term and were coming out of those meetings making public statements highly critical of past policies and of the bureaucracy. It was pretty unseemly and unwise politically. And those two things together, I think, put a lot of Koreans on edge about President Lee and his administration. And then we come to the beef issue. And to answer your and Evan's question, I don't think the beef demonstrations are primarily anti-American. There's an element of that, but that's not the primary cause. At basis, that was caused by a panic over the safety of American beef. Now, I, for one, believe that the panic was virtually totally unjustified, and there are many, many reasons for why it became a panic, but it is not unique to Korea. All over the world, people get into panics about the food they eat and overreact. And add the word foreign to it, and you put it on a logarithmic scale. And now, there were elements of anti-Americanism related to this. I won't try to go into it now, but everyone here probably knows of the complex history of U.S.-South Korean relations. And so that, in many different respects, some of those feelings came into play with the beef issue. But it would not have happened if we had not had a genuine panic in South Korea about beef. And going back to President Lee and how he's dealt with this, you know, frankly, I think that he did not have enough national political experience before he became president, because Evans and I, as foreigners, observed in Korea how powerful the street culture, the protest culture, the progressives, the civil, the NGOs can be. And you take a beef panic or something that could predictably have caused a panic, you add to it that it's American beef, You add to it that the president agrees to this deal on the eve of his unprecedented meeting with the president, President Bush, at Camp David. And you add to that the fact that the deal, in the eyes of people panicked about the safety of American beef, was, quote-unquote, worse than the deal that the Japanese have in terms of importing American beef. It should have been very predictable. In hindsight, of course, it's very clear, but I think if we should have had people both in the U.S. government and in Lee Myung-bak's administration saying, we need to deal with this more delicately. And perhaps after this very bitter experience, people in both administrations will have learned a lesson and be more careful about this very complex situation, both politically in South Korea and in terms of U.S.-Korean relations.
What I've heard from each of the three panelists, although in different ways, is that we really maybe should focus a little bit more on the challenges of governance in South Korea. And I think that Youngshik raised a couple of very interesting points that I want to go back to. And the first is this issue of generational change and the fact that Lee Myung-bak is a Cold War generation president. My question for Youngshik is how should Lee Myung-bak try to communicate with the younger generation? What do you think he really needs to do to be more effective in governance going forward?
The best means to elevate the quality of communication with the new generation in South Korean politics for Lee Myung-bak government, although it's been quite belated, should be surrounding himself with the quote-unquote right personnel who have a deep insight and the understanding of the collective psychology of the young generations. For instance, in my understanding that the historical reference points very common to the post-Korean War generation population in South Korea is, of course, not the Korean War or Cold War or Japan's occupation, but rather, to my surprise, these high school and college students indicated the experience, personal experience of the Asian financial crisis in late 1998. And David pointed out the role of panic in the Korean population, and I agree with his analysis, his emphasis on the impact of the panic. These young generations do not like the uncertainty, so that the issue of poverty is not portrayed by the young Koreans as the image of eating on the tree box, as their ancestors used to, but rather witnessing their personal financial stability at home suddenly wiped out during their crisis beyond the control of individuals and the control of the national government. The fear that the national government would make the same mistake, failing to protect us, our individual well-being stability, is very palpable and very a strong defining feature for the collective psychology of the young Koreans. And I had this conversation with my colleague in a think tank in Washington, D.C., and we jokingly said that President Lee Myung-bak still resists making fundamental change to redress such a collective psychology, which is quite different from the psychology of the Korean War generation, by still appointing people from the same generation that he feels most comfortable with. For instance, the Blue House Press Secretary and the new Chief of Staff who share their personal friendship with the President himself. But we joke that in order to appease the fear and anxiety among the majority of the Korean population who are born after the Korean War, you better appoint President Nomu-hyun or somebody Nomu-hyun looked like to show that he genuinely commits itself to communicate with the young generation in their own language.
I think it's a very interesting point. Charles, if I could ask you to pick up on that, but then also you mentioned that the Internet was really one of the key catalysts for this. And it seems that this combination of Internet and civil society is really an area where South Korea seems to be a first mover. And it poses some special challenges for governance as well. Mm-hmm. And so maybe you could build on what Yongsik has just said, but also talk a little bit about, you know, what is the significance of the way that the Internet seems to be speeding up politics in Korea.
Well, it certainly is doing that. I want to go back, however, to this issue of generations, because we're missing a generation here. There are really three parts to this. There are three generations, in effect. There's the Korean War generation. There's the generation that came of age in the 1980s, the so-called 386ers. And now there's the younger generation, the generations of the Asian financial crisis. Let's call them the IMF generation. And how they interact is a very interesting question. We have been talking for a long time about the major cleavage in Korean society being the main generational conflict being between the older generation and the 386 generation, which allegedly brought Nomu-hyun to power in 2002. But it wasn't clear what their successors, the IMF generation, would do and what side they would swing to. And I think Lee Myung-bak fundamentally miscalculated, he and his supporters, that the signs that the South Koreans in their 20s were more conservative seemed to make the older generation think that they were in their camp. But in fact, they weren't. In fact, they have yet a different view of the world, which it cannot be easily placed either in the protest generation of the 1980s, the so-called progressive camp, or in the more old-fashioned conservative camp. So how both those generations, which have dominated Korean politics up to now, deal with to get the support of the youngest voting South Koreans, I think is a key question going forward in South Korean politics. But yes, absolutely. The technology of communication and of mobilization in Korea is extraordinarily fast and almost unique in the world. This is, you know, what we have to keep our eye on. How the politicians mobilize that or manipulate that or deal with that is very critical in the kind of support they will get. As we all know, Nomu-hyun worked very effectively to utilize the Internet to gain the support of mostly younger Koreans to win the 2002 presidential election. But in the last presidential election, it didn't seem that those types of technologies were necessarily in favor of one side or the other. I do think it'll be interesting to see, and I don't know how much the Lee Myung-bak government has really effectively utilized the Internet, but it seems that the opposition or the protesters, because these are certainly not identical entities, the political opposition and the people actually out on the street, but certainly the opponents of these policies and the people concerned about them have used these technologies very effectively. And my sense is that the government has not.
Not to switch the subject completely, but I want to come back to David and ask, it seems to me actually that this is really a third generation candlelight protest. You know, the first generation was really the one that was focused more on the USFK and the traffic accident in 2002-2003. And then, of course, we had Nomu-hyun's impeachment, and that also brought people out onto the streets. My question is, which of the first and second generation protests do you think is having a greater influence on the current type of protest? Or do you see it as something that, you know, the current protest is mutating in some way, and where do you think that it might lead?
I see a lot of continuities, actually. The candlelight protests are fairly new, basically, on this scale since 2002. But, you know, Korea has had a tradition of street protests that go back for many, many decades. And it's taken on somewhat different forms. New technologies have been used. With democratization, it becomes possible to get much larger numbers out on the streets without having an absolute crisis. But
I think there are a lot of historical continuities. To continue trying to answer your question and to comment a little bit on what Charles and Yongshik said, I agree with Yongshik that it would be good in principle if Lee Myung-bak could bring in people who were younger or from different regions and so forth, and I hope he does that. But South Korea has even more political polarization, I think, than we have in the United States today. And that's understandable. For historical reasons, Korea has had a tremendous amount of tumult in the last 120 or 30 years and continues to be a divided nation, which causes directly and indirectly all sorts of tensions within South Korea. And the second, related to that, the question of the Internet, it's such a wonderful thing. There's just so much information available. But unfortunately, bad information tends to drive out good information. And I'm not sure. This has more lessons than for just Korea, I think probably for the United States. How do we as societies, how do we as governments deal with a situation in which a government has insufficient credibility with the people, and people who have not studied the issues well, sometimes people with cynical motives, put out information that is extremely distorted, exaggerated, and many times flatly incorrect, causing a panic and a political situation? It's a fundamental question, I think, for democracies in this Internet era, and it's not just in South Korea.
I think that is one of the themes that is really particularly interesting and has broader applications. I have too many questions on my list, so I'm just going to stop asking them and open it up to the floor. I see one all the way in the back. You're the first one. So,
yeah, if you could please state your name and affiliation. Two microphones are going to be circulating.
My name is Cambria. I'm a member of the society, and I'm retired. I found the analyses quite interesting. However, in speaking about street protests, I think one should also look at the way the Lee government has reacted to it, and that's by erecting a wall. And by erecting the wall, it significantly says that it has isolated itself from the people. Now, the isolation we don't see very much in the American press, given the fact that these demonstrations have been going on for almost 50 days or more. And that, so therefore, I take it that the Lee government's time in office is very short. And no one on the panel has really addressed this. And I keep wondering if it will even be shorter than the government of Chun Myung, since we're dealing also with young students. So there may be a parallel. There may not be a historical parallel. Anna Fifield in the Financial Times of Saturday had a headline which called him Bulldozer Lee. And for those of us that do remember the heavy hand of business, it reminds one in the American context of Chainsaw Al. And the conduct of the present president in South Korea follows a similar trajectory. So therefore, I would like to know, if you'd like to project, just how long the Lee government has as a government, because in the wings stands the daughter of Park Chung-hee. It's not that the party will lose power, but obviously they need a new leader. Thank you.
Okay, we're not going to start a pool here today, but if anybody who wants to respond.
Well, I think it's also one of the questions that you suggested in this paper, how long a Myung-bak government can stay in power, and if the impeachment that happened for Lee Myung-bak government is somewhat likely in a course of action. And I'd like to emphasize the learning effect of the past experience for everybody involved in Korean politics from what the impeachment taught the other Korean people in the past. So that, like the preventive measure that the experience, remembrance of the other political chaos and difficulties created by the impeachment of the Nomyeon government in the past would somewhat create a buffer effect for the Lee Myung-bak government. Although I agree that it will be extremely difficult for Lee Myung-bak government to bounce back from the initial difficulties for the first 100 days. But it is likely to just engage in muddling through, you know, politics for the remaining 2,200 days.
It seems unlikely that he would be impeached, although that's possible. It is also possible that he might resign, but given his record, that also would seem very much out of character for this president. So the alternative which you suggest is muddling through for the next 4.5 years, which is not very attractive either. And the third option is for him to fundamentally transform his leadership style. And that, too, I would say, would be very difficult. I'm somewhat surprised in a certain sense because it's not as if Lee Myung-bak hid who he was when he ran for office. He emphasized that he came from business, he knew how to run the economy. And yet you hear people now saying he treats us like employees of a big corporation and that we should do whatever he tells us. Now, there are some business people who are able to come from that background and effect a common touch. Mayor Bloomberg seems to have some success with that, at least in terms of his style. But for Lee to change his style fundamentally, I think would be very difficult. So muddling through seems to me the most likely scenario.
Okay, let me go to the front here, right here. Him and then.
Hi, I'm James Lee. I'm a member of Career Society here, and I work for a boutique investment bank here in New York. My question to you is, what is your opinion on the recently concluded additional trade negotiations with the U.S., which, if I'm correct, led to the banning or the closing the door on the importation of American beef older than 3 years? And do you think that this additional trade agreement is going to lessen the problems in any sense? And if not, what additional negotiations with Americans would be needed to get the Lee government out of trouble?
David, do you want to take a shot at that?
Politically, it appears that the mood in South Korea is changing somewhat, that after the agreement, there have been far smaller demonstrations. More of the media is saying, well, let's go with this agreement. We'll have to wait and see if that holds as the media and others look at the details of the agreement. Substantively, I mean, if one looks at the science of this, there wasn't a problem with the original agreement. The American beef is safe. 300 million Americans eat it. No American has ever gotten mad cow disease from eating American beef. It's not just Koreans. All over the world, we human beings have an extremely difficult time of calculating risk. The risk from eating American beef is less than the risk that each one of you will suffer by walking out of this building and onto the sidewalk here today. When people start talking about food, and again, as I said, you add foreign to it, and it's very easy for people to become panicked about things. I hope that this settles the problem politically. I don't have any inside information about the U.S. government thinking on this, but I'm sure that the U.S. government is not particularly pleased that it had to take what it regarded as a perfectly good agreement for both governments and essentially had to renegotiate it. They're not using the word additional renegotiation. They're saying additional negotiation, but it's a renegotiation. So I hope that it will work and that this will satisfy and reassure South Korean consumers.
Okay, let me go over here. I'll just say one other thing about this, though, and that is I think that the U.S. side has not done one thing that I think would be very important, and that is that I think that we should make clear on a global basis that we won't sell what we won't eat. And I haven't heard maybe we're doing that, but I haven't heard senior people in the administration say that explicitly. And one of the perceptions that existed in Korea on the Internet was that we were sending stuff, you know, that we're ready to discard out.
So. In fact, let me jump in. That's important because, in fact, senior U.S. government officials have said that, and they've said it repeatedly, that the beef that the United States intends to send to South Korea is exactly the beef that we all eat when we go out and have a hamburger or a steak or whatever.
Henry Segerman, International Investment Advisors. I'd just like to add a couple of points to what you said about panic and cynical motives and flat-out incorrect statements. First, just to tell you what, and everyone here, some of the incorrect statements that were disseminated, not just on the Internet, but in Korean newspapers, were that Americans do not eat their own beef, and also that Koreans have a special weakness and that they can get mad cow disease easier than other people, both of which are completely false. And if you want to think about cynical motives in triggering this panic response, just follow the money. Koreans pay, according to UBS Securities at the end of last year, $72 per kilo for their beef, but the average price around the world is under $5 per kilo. So since U.S. beef was banned, the farm industry in Korea has made an enormous profit from the jacked-up prices of beef in Korea. And these poor kids who are out there having this panic response, you know, they're just going to have less spending money because a hamburger is going to cost them an arm and a leg.
Okay. No need for a response there. Let me go back over here to this lady.
Yeah.
Hold on just a moment. Take the mic.
Sorry, it's Rhonda Haubin. I'm a featured writer for OMI News International. I'm also at an author, co-author of the book Netizens on the History and Impact of Usenet and the Internet. And the reason I raise that is, I guess my question is about the netizen generation, that what we see is that there's a different culture among people online where, in fact, they can discuss things, they can debate things. There's what they call vertical as opposed to horizontal. It's not hierarchical, but people try to create things that are more equal. And there's I'm co-author of an article in the book Korea Yearbook 207 that discusses that the development of netizens in South Korea is there's been a set of developments pretty much since 2000. This is not a new phenomenon. So I wondered if anybody would like to speak to that. And secondly, I think you're really being unfair about the beef. I have looked into this, that there was mad cow disease discovered in 2003. The Koreans made some arrangements to change the situation. Then there was bone in the beef, and in 2005 and then 2006, there were other instances in the U.S. And then the specified risk materials, the original agreement had different sets of specified risk materials than the U.S. has as its regulation. And in fact, there was a letter written after that addressing that. So I think it really should be opened up that there's been a real problem with beef around the world in terms of the fact that there's a need for caution when there's a question about health and not for the market to take over. And I think there's good reasons and lots of details. I don't eat, I won't eat chopped meat after some of what I've seen going on. And I have real questions about beef after seeing some of the things that have happened. My husband, who's very thinking, didn't want to eat beef after the way things were treated with regard to When the mad cow situation was developed, there's an issue of prions. There's an issue of diseases that are related that is not taken seriously in the U.S. So I think there's a very serious issue about all that. When people look into it and see how that's treated in the U.S., and particularly where there's a case where there are people want to export their beef, and they want to test for mad cow disease, and the U.S. government goes and challenges that in court and says they can't do that. You know, this is a very serious health situation, and I think the Koreans are doing the American people a favor by bringing some of these things to light, and I think this should be treated much more seriously among in our discussion and not making fun of it. It's a very serious matter. Thank you.
Okay. Is there any response from our panel?
Yeah. Well, it's not about the inspection of the safety of the beef, but I'd like to point out why the Koreans came out in the street. I tie that phenomenon to the lack of functioning party politics. The parties are not doing their jobs in terms of aggregating, reflecting the public interest, and disseminating correct, reliable information on behalf of the public and the government, so that people rely on internet to get the information. People go out in the street to, you know, make known their own, you know, respective agendas to the government. So the raw clash between the government and the civil society, in my opinion, is likely to continue if the other Korean politics maintain the same institutional structure based upon single-member, small constituency for National Assembly, which is not best designed to reflect broader national interest rather than local interest. And the presidency is limited to a single term of 5 years, so that the public lacks the method to quote-unquote punish the government for their wrongdoings in timely manner. They have to wait at least 5 years to raise your voice. They have to wait at least 4 years to hold the members of National Assembly failing to represent their true interest and succumb themselves to wrong information. Wrong information, so that people cannot wait to register their desire to make the democracy truly accountable without having to wait such a long period of time.
Let me go all the way to the back, and while we're waiting for the mic to go to the lady, I'll just say that one very interesting question related to what we just heard is whether or not, or in what way, what is happening in Korea could actually influence consumer safety consciousness here in the United States. And I think that's an open question. So please, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. My name is Kiwa, and I'm from Seoge Times, published in New York, and it's a Korean language daily newspaper. And I just heard all my news international reporters' explanation about what's going on. And I'm more like good in Korean. I'm native Korean. I came here very late, so my English is not really good. I hope I can I can explain it very clearly. But there's one. Okay, there's always a chance that something might go wrong, like E. coli or like latest tomato incidents. Everything. There's always danger, but there's something when. It's different when to say that American cows, you might get the mad cow disease. Maybe she's suspected to have a mad cow disease, but we have to test. But what Korean newspapers and broadcasting companies, especially like OMI News and Hangul and NBC and KBS did was she has mad cow disease. Now she's suspected to have a mad cow disease. And even NBC in the nationally televised news program said, do we have to risk our lives to eat American beef? So what I'm going to point out is that if there was no brainwashing propaganda by this all these newspapers. I really want to point out this brainwashing propaganda because this is really serious terrorism. I'm a mother of a young little girl, and she loves American beef. And all of a sudden, these people comes out on the TV. Americans, you know, you're going to die. You know, and we all clearly remember in the beginning, there was a 15-year-old girl come out. I don't want to die, you know. Don't kill us, President. I mean, I was so upset. And that's around the same time I saw in that All My News website that they were promoting this book, Slaughterhouse, which was like published in 1997. And this is author who's, by the way, a former journalist and award-winning author from America says Koreans are very smart. It's very dangerous. It's very dirty. They are smart. I will join your protest. And she's like encouraging like this. And I was so, you know, mad at her. I actually sent a personal email to her. So I want to ask these experts in Korean Peninsula problem. If you take these rotten Korean media newspapers and broadcasting companies who has no shame lying blatantly nationwide, tell people that you're going to die because basically all American cows are, you know, have a risk of mad cow disease. If you take that factor out, will Korean president now be in this situation and all these people be out on the street like that? I mean, as if the Korean press were very fair, at least to have some sense of, you know, justice or journalism. I want to point out that brainwashing propaganda by the Korean media.
Charles, okay, Charles and then David.
Issues of fair and balanced media are not unique to South Korea by any means. I think there needs to be an honest debate, and the fact that misinformation may be disseminated through the internet, for example, is not going to go away. The question is how do we respond, different media, different elements of the public and the government, to such issues? And I think that the government's response has been a major factor in this. They were very slow to respond to it. Lee took his time in changing his cabinet. And I think they were really taken aback. I think they were stunned that this agreement, which they thought was an easily done deal, which after all had been pushed very heavily by the Nomu-hyun administration when it created such a backlash. And I think it had a lot to do with first with the content, but also with the style in which it was pushed. And as far as Scott's comment, I think issue in Korea has already helped to trigger a discussion within the United States about the safety of American beef for Americans and what kinds of inspections are and should be done. To the extent that this creates an honest and open debate, I think this is a very important phenomenon.
I have to disagree a bit with what Charles has just said. And I want to make very clear that I'm not making fun of people who are panicked by the beef issue. I disagree entirely based upon my study of the issue, but I'm not making fun of them. Many of you may recall that in the United States, what was it, about 10 years ago, we had our own mad cow panic when the British were having such a terrible, terrible problem. There was a period of weeks, perhaps a few months, in which there was a great debate in the United States, and for reasons that I can barely recall and probably too complex to go into here, the American public gradually was reassured. Beef consumption levels went back to where they were, and that has remained the situation up till now. So I doubt that there's going to be much of a discussion about the safety of American beef based upon the protest in South Korea, because we've already gone through this and the American people have been reassured by the beef. And I would just, at the risk of getting into a debate here about specifically the science of the safety of American beef, which I don't think most people are interested in, I want to just make it clear that I do not agree with any of the remarks made by the Oh My News reporter. If you really want to know the danger in eating American beef, that is, in South Korea, 300 million people in the United States almost daily eat American beef. No one has gotten mad cow disease from it.
there is almost nothing in life that we do that is that danger-free. We have to have some balance and perspective if we're going to make important political decisions. Do the United States and South Korea not have far more important issues individually and bilaterally to deal with than the safety of American beef in scientific and substantive terms? What about terrorism? What about Iraq? Should South Korea be helping us out in Iraq and Afghanistan? These are serious issues. The real danger in eating American beef is that because South Korean beef and even Australian beef is more expensive than American beef, when South Koreans finally do, and they will eventually resume American beef and this will all be forgotten, there will be a demonstrable increase in coming decades in colon cancer and things like that, hypertension and heart disease. There will be a measurable increase in the number of Koreans who die from eating more beef than they've eaten in the past. Now, who's going to protest that? And that's not a joke. That is deadly serious. If Koreans want to be perfectly healthy, they should probably not eat Korean beef either.
Scott.
Yeah. Young-shik, please.
Rather than testing the safety of the beef, because I'm doomed, I just went directly from Penn Station to my favorite restaurant, Ganmyeok, and ate a lot of beef already. So I'm living proof, and I hope that I'll survive until the signing of the FTA. But I'd like to just ask your own opinion about whether the renegotiation would be enough to water down all this political turmoil regarding the beef trade in signing the bilateral free trade agreement between the two countries. Because for Koreans, majority of Koreans believe that Korea made an extra mileage to make the FTA, signing of FTA work. So they believe that now ball is in the U.S. court. But in my opinion, the Americans would believe that beef negotiation is not the final end game of the signing FTA, but only jumpstart, the beginning game of the FTA. And the U.S.-Korea FTA is not only about beef, but also about other aspects of bilateral trade. So in case that the FTA is a shutdown in the U.S. Congress because of competitive presidential election, think about the swing states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan. Then if the United States declined to sign FTA, then it might pour a fuel on the anti-American sentiment in South Korea, even on a temporary basis, because of the discrepancy between in perception.
Okay, we come over here to the middle. Yeah. And by the way, we're coming near the end, and so I, as a moderator, I really like to offer a prize to the people with the shortest questions at the end of the session. So please.
Well, before I submit the short question, I'd like to... I'm Jay Hong, a retired physician. I'd like to congratulate Front Office Korea Society putting this seminar up, because I think my 20 years association with organization, this is kind of unique. I really appreciate it, and I think it's very important. Having said that, about 2 months ago, Dr. Armstrong said right there, introducing some of the comments made the Italian statesman or politician quoted. He said, now that we found the Italy, now let's find the Italian. You know, after you said that, Dr. Armstrong, and I really, on the way home, still do think like this. Okay, we found the Korea now with the economy and, democracy and all that. But what are we as a Korean? What are the Koreans now? Who can govern this Korean people? Little or small incidents, like Mr. Straub said, there will be hundreds of them ahead of us, Im Young-bak's the tenure, at least. And every issue, every time people come up with a candlelight like that, And we are going to see a lot more, I'm afraid. Who can really govern? And what are the Korean people now? I cannot answer. I wonder. If you have any thought on this, I'll appreciate it.
Let me very briefly answer that impossible question. I don't know specifically how we can resolve this, but the question of governing Koreans is a very serious one. And I think it goes back to something Yongshik said. There has been a disconnect between the political system, particularly the political party system, and what we might call the extra-systemic activity that is related to politics of a great many Korean people. Many Korean people clearly feel that their interests or things that concern them are not addressed at all or not very well addressed by their elected officials. So the question is how to bring these two together in order to avoid constant instability and this sort of thing happening over and over again. I don't have the answer to that, but that's the question we have to ask. I think that's the goal we have to try to achieve, to bring these concerns of the Korean public together with an effective political system.
I mean, I just want to say, before, and we're going to go right here after this, but, you know, one interesting question is where has the National Assembly been in all of this? And I think that this just underscores Charles's point, that there is still a huge political governance issue related to the fact that there is an election in April, and then the next month people are on the streets. And so I think that really gets at some of the core of the challenges that we're facing in terms of thinking about how Korean politics can be stabilized.
Hi, Sam Baker, Transnational Research. My question has to do with the FTA and the likelihood of it being passed. I know you guys are Korean experts, but I'm wondering if you could just, anybody comment on the dynamics in U.S. Congress, if what the your expectations are for the passage of the FTA.
I don't have inside information, but just from listening to the public debate and what the presidential candidates have said and so forth, it strikes me as quite unlikely that it will be passed this year in the United States, and I wonder whether Lee Myung-bak should even try, frankly, to pass it this year. We've had enough of this polarization. I think we need a little breathing space. I personally think that I'm an advocate of free trade and the principle of it, and I think that this agreement between the U.S. and South Korea overall is in the interest of both peoples. However, economics is not everything in life, and if we have substantial, even minority, not even a majority, who is adamantly convinced that this is bad, say, for example, in South Korea, well, then maybe we should take things slow until those people can be persuaded. And in fact, there will be people and industries in both countries who will be affected, and both governments need to reassure those people and those sectors that they will, to a reasonable extent, be accommodated. If we do not pass this year, I am still fairly, or at least cautiously optimistic, that it will pass. But, for example, in the United States, whether Obama wins or McCain wins, I suspect it won't. There won't be terribly active consideration of the FTA in the U.S. until maybe a year or two later. Obama has already put himself on record as expressing concern about it, so he would have to have, shall we say, an additional negotiation with the South Koreans over some issues related to the FTA. And even if McCain wins, and he's expressed strong support for it, he's probably going to have to deal with a Congress that is overwhelmingly controlled by the Democrats. And whether Obama or McCain is president, they're going to have issues in their first year as president that are going to be, frankly, far more important than the U.S.-Korea FTA, like what do we do about Iraq, and what do we do about Afghanistan? What do we do about energy prices and the fact that the U.S. economy is in very bad shape right now? But I think we can be reasonably hopeful that we will get beyond this. And even if it's passed in South Korea, I hope South Koreans, when people in South Korea start saying, well, if we pass it and the Americans don't pass it, we may have anti-Americanism here in South Korea. That's not helpful. In 5 or 6 years ago, when President Kim Dae-jung was president, his administration, at the beginning of the administration, came to the U.S. and said, let's have a bilateral investment treaty, which is also a big deal. And the Americans said, well, we'd like to have one, but you know we have a standard template for these with countries all over the world. Are you sure that you can do this politically? President Kim said, absolutely, let's do it. And so we began the negotiations, and some of you may remember that after a few years of negotiations, it became politically impossible to do it in South Korea. So it was ended because of South Korean opposition. So we both have our own domestic politics and talk about, well, if you don't do this, we're going to become anti-American, or if you don't do that, we're going to become anti-Korean. That's not the way we should be talking about each other.
Come over here.
Nicholas Chavez, I'm running a website on sustainable development. Now, I'm trying to be positive and to help you with finding, for the summing up, some ideas. Now, let's agree. This is not about beef. This is about credibility. Now, the problem here in the U.S. was that the chief lobbyist for the Cattlemen's Association, a lady, became Secretary of Agriculture, and she sought to help the interests of the cattlemen by putting under the table some cases of bad cow disease that supposedly originated from Canadian cows. All right. The problem didn't become mad cow disease. The problem was plain and simple credibility in a secretary of agriculture. Now, this lady ended up being, you know, having had to leave Washington, and she was sent into exile to New York, where she became head of UNICEF. Now, having said this, let's get back to what we heard here, Iraq and Afghanistan. So the real issue here is Iraq, where the question is now, how will be the reaction to the U.S.? Now, one of the candidates says that with the Korean experience, there is a future in this kind of relation with Iraq. So my question to you really is, with that experience that we discussed here now for 1.5 hours, what do you think will be the standing in terms of credibility of the U.S. in Iraq, having learned the situation now from Korea? Now, does a Korean think today that the U.S. is helpful in a reunification of Korea? Does Korea today really give full credibility to the United States? Now, is the beef just some kind of, flag to flatter around, while the issues really are something completely different?
Charles, why don't you get us started? Okay. We're going to give everybody a chance on this one.
I'll do what I can. I think the notion that's been going around some circles in Washington that South Korea is a good model for Iraq is not a very well thought out one, and probably a grave mistake for Iraq. But I do think that the U.S.-South Korean relationship is generally in pretty good shape, and I think that the beef issue will itself go away, but I think there are certainly much more pressing issues of the U.S.-RK relationship. David talked about a few, but more specifically about the U.S. in South Korea, about the positioning of U.S. forces and South Korean forces also in Iraq. These questions will come up and remains to be seen what will be done. I think one question, though, that we haven't really gotten to too much here is how will Lee Myung-bak recover from this? What will this do for the next 4.5 years, should the president be in power that long, of this administration? And I find it very difficult to imagine any very successful way that President Lee can dig himself out of this.
Young-sik?
Well, I agree with you that if I were President Lee himself, then Well, first of all, I wouldn't want to be in his shoes. People talk about bringing back Park Geun-hye to share the responsibility of governance to appease public anger and frustration toward the Lee Myung-bak government. But I personally think that they wouldn't really solve the problem because, as I said, that the deeper problem lies in the political institutions, which will not allow the periodic judgment and input by the civil society to hold the government accountable. Maybe the long-term solution is the constitutional revisions to change the system from presidential system to parliamentary system so that people can more frequently, in an institutional manner, register their input about selecting and supporting and rejecting the government. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the Lee Myung-bak government can do to come back on the right track. In the baseball analogy, some people may say that the first 100 days would be just a major league season in April. New York Yankees may turn around and Mets after fire the manager, make a miraculous comeback and play World Series against the Boston Red Sox.
It's where they got rid of the manager first.
Right.
But not the owner.
I don't know. I mean, even the other great Korean Peninsula Canal project, it's not based upon a careful calculation of feasibility. President Lee himself said that he got this idea from the canal system in Germany, and the success of the Cheonggyecheon restoration project. But I did my calculation then at the same pace of the success in Germany, in order to complete the project in Korea, it would take the 90 years. And if you emulate the success of restoration of Cheonggyecheon and build the great canal connecting four major rivers, well, it took 3 years for Seoul City Hall to clean up Cheonggyecheon, which is only 3 miles. If you apply the same rate of success to the whole project, then it will take at least 250 years.
David?
Clearly, the mood against President Lee in South Korea is very severe. But there are a number of things that we should keep in mind before we become too pessimistic about the situation. First, South Korea is a presidential system. The presidency remains a powerful institution, and there are a number of things. As Young-sik pointed out, and also as Charles did, there are basically only two routes for him to go. One is for him to resign, and that doesn't seem to be in his personality, and the other is impeachment, and there was a very bad experience in South Korea a few years ago when the impeachment of President Noh was attempted and failed. I think he's probably learned a very important lesson, which is that he cannot just do what he thinks is right. And I have no reason to doubt that he thought he was doing the right thing in terms of the substance when he opened the Korean market to beef. But now he's going to be much more careful about this, and he'll probably appoint new presidential secretaries and some new cabinet ministers who may be more politically attuned than perhaps some of his other people were. I think he will probably have a different rhetorical style. He's already made two apologies. So there are a number of things that he can do to try to prevent the situation from getting any worse. And as time passes and no Koreans die because of mad cow disease and so forth, I think there's a possibility that his popularity can increase. So he's obviously got a hard time, but we shouldn't give up on the hopes for stability in South Korea.
Okay, we have time for only one last question, and I see our distinguished chairman here, so I think I better turn it to him.
I don't want to intrude on anybody else's question time, but nobody has asked this question yet, and I thought I would. You have all dwelled very correctly, I think, on the internal problem within Korea and the governmental and generational and other issues that are behind all of what's going on in the streets of Seoul right now. You've touched very briefly on what the United States has done by being flexible on the beef negotiation and, in effect, renegotiating the deal, which I think has given a helpful hand to President Lee and his government at a difficult time. Has the United States done all it can under the current circumstances? Is there anything else that the United States might usefully do in support of our Korean ally at what is obviously a very difficult time for him and his government?
Why don't we start with David and come back this way?
Maybe the best thing the U.S. government could do right now is just leave South Korea alone for a little while. For example, I love being out of government because I can be very blunt. President George Bush is planning to visit reportedly South Korea in July. Why in heaven's name is George Bush going to South Korea? Now, I would almost never say that because I'm a strong supporter of U.S.-South Korean relations. But he is leaving office in a few months. He's extremely unpopular, both in the United States and South Korea. We are coming off massive protests involving the United States. It would be better for both countries and for the U.S. relationship if we just, the U.S., just laid back for a while and let President McCain or let President Obama develop the next relationship with President Lee.
I'd like to highlight the underappreciated positive effect of the U.S. government granting visa waiver programs. It has a very symbolic and psychological impact on the young generations in South Korea, enhancing the image of the United States, fair, open, and welcoming Koreans into their own system. Of course, the beef issue has been very thorny and turbulent, but we should not forget what the United States correctly did to elevate the level of bilateral relationship. I'd like to also add one more point that which we did not really discuss extensively is U.S.-North Korea dynamics. Exacerbating the six-party process with North Korea would enhance the sensitivity and anxiety among South Koreans for the United States playing tough cop while risking the national security and well-being of South Korean people as a potentially becoming innocent victim between recalcitrant North Korea and bullying the United States. Addressing the South Koreans' fear of being entrapped between the United States and North Korea because of the standoff and stalemate with regard to nuclear negotiation should be avoided.
I agree that both sides should take the light off of this particular issue for the time being. I think the U.S. Renegotiation or additional negotiation on this has shown a very positive flexibility. And for the Americans to understand that it is not so much about the health of beef or even the economics of the beef, but really it's a highly emotional issue and that the Koreans' feelings need to be assuaged to some extent. And there have to be symbolic gestures taken to reassure the people of South Korea that the U.S. Does appreciate their concerns, even if they don't necessarily agree with them, and that there are other areas of their relationship on which they can agree and move forward.
I would just say that it seems to me that the South Korean domestic political situation needs to be stabilized first before the U.S. takes any additional actions. In any way toward the South Korean government. So thank you all for coming, and I'll turn it back over to Evans.
Let me thank our panelists for a really superb job today. This has been one of the liveliest and most informative discussions I've ever heard in these four walls. I was really struck by the point that Dr. Armstrong made just a moment ago about what needs to be done and what the other panelists mentioned as well, and I would associate myself with many of their comments. It is obviously a highly emotional issue. And the two words that I've been using in recent weeks in my own communication with colleagues in Washington, both inside and outside of government, is that perhaps the two most important words that can guide American action in all of this are understanding and flexibility. And I think, in my own narrow perspective, looking at what Washington has been doing, they have been trying to demonstrate understanding of the dilemma that Korea and the Korean president face, and they have also, I think, demonstrated, I think, a helpful measure of flexibility in agreeing to reconfigure, if you will, this this agreement. Let me thank all of the panelists once again for what I think has been a valuable and insightful presentation today. Three things really stood out for me as I was listening to this useful discussion. And that is the points about generational change and the impact that that has on the overall political dynamic in Korea. I don't think that's sufficiently understood in America today. And as we've seen, it may not be sufficiently understood in Korea as well, based on what's happened in the streets in recent weeks. The other point about the role of the Internet. Korea is probably the most wired country in the world. Sometimes that is for good. Sometimes perhaps not. And then the last point about the political disconnect that was discussed, the role of the National Assembly or the lack thereof, the breakdown that we may be seeing in political in the political system that has been in place for many years in Korea, and the need to figure out a way, perhaps through some adjustments to electoral schedules. These are all things that I think are well worth consideration by all of us here, but also the call for us to calm down, step back, take a breather, and try to put all of these issues in perspective and try to talk about them as reasonably and unemotionally as we can. And on that last point, I'm reminded that during the long, hot summer of 2002, I was on a Korean college campus, which was a very dangerous place for an American diplomat to be that summer. And I was facing a very rowdy group of Korean students who were saying some very unpleasant things about my country and my embassy and me, and many of them had participated in some of these demonstrations. And I posed the following question to them, since they were all headed for the latest candlelight demonstration. I asked them whether they knew where the first candlelight vigil had taken place in Korea in 2002. And to a person, they all answered, well, Gwanghwamun, down by the gate. That's where these things happened. And I said, no. I said, you don't know, do you? And they looked at me with the same puzzle looks that you have in your faces. The very first candlelight vigil that took place in the aftermath of the deaths of those two young girls in Korea that started the first phase of this took place on a U.S. military base. And the participants were American soldiers and their families and their children who went out as a way of demonstrating their solidarity with the families of the dead children and as a way of expressing their own condolences and their own sincere horror at what had happened. So the next time you look at the candlelight vigil, remember where it started, not quite where you think. Thank you all for coming today.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, or management.
Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Journal. Membership may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.